And now we move into the 1980s, a very pivotal decade that we've already talked a little bit about with Concord. And joining me right now, we have Greg Anderson, who was very instrumental in helping raise the money and get the museum and the Aviation Center open. Welcome back, Greg.
Thank you.
A name that is almost synonymous with the EIA, that is Rutan. This is Dick Rutan, of course. Welcome back. Gene McNeely, who you know from the Aeroshell team, and we're going to give a little insight that you might not know about Gene and his tie to EIA in the 80s. Welcome, Gene.
Thank you.
And Les Brody with the Concorde. Glad to have you here.
Thanks very
much. And would you like to introduce your two
crewmates? I have Captain Richard Owen, who's a training captain on Concorde, and I've got Senior Engineer Officer Trevor Norcott, who is one of our main trainers on the senior engineering side of Concorde as well.
Excellent.
And none of us have been to Oshkosh before, but we've had a great day here today, had a ball, and we've been up in the tri-motor, etc. So now we're going to represent the Concorde fleet.
Very good, very good. I want to actually start with Dick, and we're actually going to back up into the 70s because your brother Bert designed the Very Easy, and it was debuted here in 1975, is that correct? And you flew it here setting a distance record for the airplane as well.
That's right, it was class 1A and we flew it between here and Menominee. Spent the whole day and that was my first induction to long range flying. And of course, we stayed with it a long time and ended up flying farther than any airplane has ever flown.
There's quite an evolution.
Fly.
What was the crowd's reaction to the Very Easy in 1975?
Well, the crowd reaction was really interesting. Of course, you know, the EAA is a very welcoming place. But, you know, here Bert shows up with an airplane that's built out of bed sheets and honey and flying backwards. And, of course, it's going to enlist somebody's interest for sure. So, anyway, it evolved from that, and he ended up building a home built that made astronauts. So that's the evolution.
What are your first impressions of Oshkosh when you landed that first day?
Well, it overwhelmed. You know, back in those days, it was before cell phones. You know, back in the old days, you know, no cell phones and no internet, thank goodness, and flying Volkswagen engines. So from Volkswagen engines to rockets that can go into space, it's all the spirit of EAA. It all started right here because you have the freedom. Thanks to Paul, and they gave us the freedom to innovate and build airplanes. You know, I built a couple, and in the back of my Bearcoot, it says, because you're required to put this statement. It says, this airplane does not comply with the FAA standards. Blah, blah, blah. It's a requirement. It's a law, right? And underneath that, I put my own. And I did it after I got inspected. And what it said was, it says, that's why it's more efficient and more fun, and it's safer and more fun, and more fun to fly.
Thank you. And just a few years after that, we saw Voyager for the first time, and I remember the pictures from that year of the outline in the grass on the flight line where you could see where the grass was still green under the fuselage and wings of the airplane, and everything else around it was absolutely trampled down by everybody looking at that airplane.
Well, That memory of 1984. No, anyway, Gene and I flew it in here from Menominee or from someplace, and we orbited overhead until the air show was done. And when the air show was done, we brought it down and landed it and taxied in to Air Show Center. And the reception that we received was, you know, monumental. It was very sporting to see that. And I kept having to remind people, I says, hey, we ain't done this yet.
Yeah.
But anyway, it was going to be 2 years after that that we did actually successfully, much to my surprise, fly around the world unrefueled on the first try. And I'm still amazing from that. But the memory of that, of circling overhead, and everybody pulled out a white handkerchief. And we looked down, Gene and I looked down, and here's the whole crowd, the Oshkosh ground, and everybody had a white handkerchief. I kept thinking, do they know we haven't flown around the world yet? But we landed, and one of the... And one of the most memorable things about that whole reception that we had here at Oshkosh in 1984 was one person, and I'll never forget. And outside of my own mother, Audrey, when we got climbed out of the airplane that day and had a hug by Audrey, and I thought, that has got to be the sweetest, most wonderful person that ever drew a breath of air. And it was a real honor to meet her and know her. And she put up with Paul and Tom all these years, and you know, God bless her, and I kiss her for that.
Steve,
yep.
I think a lot of us probably remember that flying in and the display and the reception that the Poberesnys and EAA members gave the Voyager team. But a memory that sticks with me of that day is after you were on the flight line for a while, we decided to put it in the Weeks hangar for the night. And several people went over to push it in, and as we were getting it set up, it had to fit just right over there. It's a big airplane. And I saw a fellow walking along the leading edge of the long wing, and I later found out it was John Rontz, who designed the airfoil. And he was walking along and writing in a little notebook along the leading edge of this unique airplane. And I asked him what he was doing, and he said, "I'm counting the bug strikes, little smushes of bug bodies on the leading edge of the wing, and I'm going to put that in the computer and calculate the laminar airflow disturbance that those bug strikes caused over 9 days or whatever it was."
3 minutes and 44 seconds.
And I thought, if anybody's going to do this, these guys are going to do it because they've thought of everything. And you landed with not too many gallons anyway. It was that kind of calculation. Really disciplined approach to the event.
There's just a real quick note on that. John Rontz was the airfoil genius, but he forgot one thing, and that is what happens to his airfoil in rain. And in Mojave, we didn't have a chance to test it in rain, and Gene and I were out on the eastern edge of the valley, and we were doing some tests. I looked over there, and there was a little verga of rain, so I thought, well, heck, we'll just punch into it. And we punched into the rain, and it lost 62% of its lift off the canard, and the nose started down. And no matter what I could do, I couldn't pull back. I pulled back full forward, power, everything. There was no way we can get it up. And I looked, and there was no way that I could turn Voyager around and fly back out of it. And I actually ordered Gina to get her parachute on and get out. And she was in the process of putting her parachute on. And I thought, what a shame. Nobody's ever going to know what happened or why it happened. They just see the wreckage. And then she come up and says, well, what are you going to do? And I says, well, I'm going to stay here and see if I can save the airplane, but you're getting out. And I ordered her to bail out. And as hard-headed, you know, God bless her, as hard-headed as she was, she unclipped her parachute, threw it in the back, and says, if you're staying, so am I. And I looked at it and I says, okay, girl, I give you one chance to live, because there was no survival of this thing. It couldn't pull the nose up. We were going to crash in the high desert. But for some reason, at the last minute, we flew out of this thing, and it started to dry out. And as it dried out and the rain stopped, the nose came up. Anyway, I flew it back to Bert, and fortunately, Bert is alive today for one reason. He was not at the airport that day, because when I called him up and I says, hey, Bert, and I told him what happened, and he looked at me, or he said over the telephone, he says, well, Dick, don't fly in the rain. Anyway, it went back, and John Rontz put it in a wind tunnel and put some vortex generators on it, and he fixed that. And we never had another chance to test that because there wasn't any rain, and we found ourselves. And the first time it flew in rain after his test, for a test, was going through Typhoon Mars out over Guam. And we're in heavy rain. And it worked.
Greg, as we mentioned, you were very instrumental in bringing the Aviation Center and the museum to life here. What was the process that you went through with Tom to raise the money and get this started?
Well, I started in 83, and we were just into our Wings on Dreams capital campaign for the huge amount of money of $10 million, which is a lot of money, but now there are campaigns that are hundreds of millions and billions. But it was a great exercise that sticks in my memory very vividly. We generated a lot of support and drew a lot of blue ribbon support from people like Barry Goldwater, who chaired the campaign, John Denver, Baron Hilton, Tom Watson, on. People came up to stand beside Paul and Tom and EAA members to build this facility. And The chapter network was very active. Jerry Traeger and a team of chapter leaders generated the advocacy program and support from the membership. The members really pushed it over the top. We were generating support from foundations and corporations, but when we got close to $10 million, we started the Charter Contributors Campaign, and up in the Whitman Concourse in the museum today are about 5,000 bricks. And I walk through there today, Steve, and people are pointing to it and smiling like it's their piece of this place. And the Wings on Dreams campaign was an effort to, A, be permanent here in Oshkosh, but to capture the spirit of AirVenture and put it in a facility that would generate that excitement and that enthusiasm year-round, and then also be that kind of focal point that draws the interest and enthusiasm from people who come to AirVenture and then send it out to chapters and young people and aviation organizations around the world, really. There's bricks up there from Oshkosh, and there's other bricks from, I remember one from Ouagadougou, Upper Volta, West Africa, that came in at the tail end of the campaign. So it was a great show of EAA spirit at a time when the economy wasn't the best, but people believed in this cause, and of course, Paul and Tom was very much in a leadership position in that campaign. We had an opening that 1983 AirVenture or Flying at that time, and I know Baron Hilton was the master of ceremonies. It was a pretty powerful moment. It was my second AirVenture out of now 37. I keep coming back, but it was the time I also realized on July 30th it was my anniversary, and then as long as I worked for EAA 21 years, I would never have another anniversary on the day I was supposed to with my wife, because it was always in the middle of AirVenture. So it's memorable for many reasons.
It's a good thing you have an understanding wife.
I do, for sure.
And Gene, you know, we know you from the Aeroshell team, from racing at Reno in the T6, but in the early 80s, you came here with a different mission in mind to Oshkosh.
I came, I believe, in 81, somewhere in there, and my first watching the team fly, the Christian Eagles, and Danielle and flying the formation, I just got hooked on that, and I bought a Christian Eagle kit, and then started competing, and I'm an old crop duster, so I retired and met the boys on the team and joined the team, and we started flying, and we begged Tommy and said, can we come up? And we weren't the Aeroshell team, we were the North American team, and we finally got an invite to come fly, and that kind of started the whole thing. And then we started chasing sponsors and got Aeroshell on board. But my biggest memory with EAA is every year at our ICAST convention, we would go to Tommy and would say, Tommy, you need to do a night show. And he said, oh no, man, we're busy, everybody's committed. And we did that for about 3 years because Sun and Fun was doing a night show. And finally he said, I tell you what, I'm gonna do a night show. And if it fails, you guys will never come back. So, I never forget our first night show here. Tommy was scared to death, and it went over big time. And now we're doing two night shows, and I got to fly in the first night show here with the team, and really enjoyed that.
That's excellent. So, gentlemen, your impressions now that you've got to walk around the grounds today for the very first time.
I'm speechless, as you can see. Coming from the United Kingdom, where land is at a premium, I just was absolutely awestruck, or as you Americans would say, it was just an awesome sight. You know, camper vans everywhere, airplanes everywhere. It was just magnificent. We had a cracking day, didn't we? We enjoyed ourselves enormously.
Yep. Yeah, it was just amazing, and we managed to go up in a tri-motor, so we did fly at Oshkosh, even though we couldn't fly our Concorde here this time.
There you go.
And we did see from the air the true scale of the event. It's just amazing.
Yeah.
the largest thing we've ever seen in an air show. We went to plenty of air shows as well as Oshkosh with the Concorde, so we've got lots of experience of that. But it was just, as Richard said, awesome today.
Good. Well, gentlemen, I appreciate all of you taking some time to share some of your Oshkosh memories with us. The 1980s were a very turning point for the organization with Concorde, with Voyager, the opening of the Aviation Center, of course, lots of home builds going through it. So thank you all for joining us this evening and sharing your Oshkosh memories.